Greetings, this is Joe McKesson, Marketing Director for the New Orleans Opera, a.k.a. Opera Joe, and welcome to this week's edition of New Orleans Opera at Large. I'm here today with probably one of the most exciting guests we're going to have this season, among many, but this one, for me, is the most exciting. I am trying to discover New Orleans, as I've said before, one piece of art or one artist at a time, and this year, one of the jewels in our season is Champion. Terrence Blanchard's opera Champion, based on the story of Emile Griffith. This story is profound on many, many levels, not just from an auditory point of view, not just from a visual point of view, not even the story. It's how it all impacts you at once. And in that, it is what opera is always meant to be, a live, living performance of a section of time that is supposed to impact you to understand movements in life that are not necessarily yours to understand, or something that you want to understand that will give you at least a little bit more light on the subject. Opera as the Gesamtkunstwerk, the complete work, brings everything together. And that's something that our guest today, Terrence Blanchard, has done very well. Now, I want to give you all just a little bit of background on this amazing artist. There's a lot of things about Terrence Blanchard that here in New Orleans, we don't even know, because he's had a profound life. First of all, I first came across this man through his soundtracks. He's a prolific soundtrack writer, having written over almost 36 total soundtracks, if not more.
Close to 50.
Close to 50. See, there's so many that you don't even know. Yeah. See, and even I don't know. And that's why I love to discover it. But it was vis-a-vis these soundtracks that I came to know your work because of the themes that were attached to the different characters. It's such an intimate approach to soundtrack writing. So I'm really pleased to have you here today, Terrence. Welcome to the show. Welcome
to
our podcast.
Thank you. It's great to be here. I'm excited about being here.
Really. Well, I am too. I'm a little cock-a-hoops, as I call it, because I'm a little giddy. So I hope you'll forgive me.
No, that's fine. That's fine.
So we're here to talk about Champion because a lot of people with the opera don't know what Champion's about. Mm-hmm. And I want to kind of walk them through this as we get closer to the performance so that people can kind of understand what it is a little bit at a time. New operas are always enigmatic to people. Mm. They make them worried. They're like, well, this is my big seat, and I don't know if this is what I want to see. Right. But more and more we're learning that opera is the same as it ever was. Mm-hmm. It has very specific purposes that it's supposed to bring across in numbers and arias and soliloquies and dramatic moments, and that's something that Champion has in many, many ways on many different levels. Mm-hmm. So why don't you, I want to kind of step back a little bit from that, you know, because I was talking about your soundtrack work, and, you know, it was the soundtrack work that led me to hear New York Scene. Mm. Like, I didn't hear New York Scene until a decade after it had come out.
Oh, okay.
And that was like your first Grammy win, right?
Well,
collectively.
Yeah, I mean, actually, the one of the first was I think it was Tale of God's Will.
Tale of God's Will, the Requiem for Katrina.
Yeah. And it was a very interesting time because I always talk about how I never felt like I earned that Grammy. I felt like the city of New Orleans earned that Grammy.
Wow.
You know, because the story itself was so powerful. And there was so much that we were trying to say musically. Basically, what I was doing was trying to tell the story of everybody's experience in the aftermath of the hurricane here in New Orleans. And that emotional energy just propelled all the music for that particular CD.
Right.
So it's one of the things, when I talk about that one in particular, I always said the city of New Orleans won that Grammy. I was just a part of that moment in time.
Wow, well that's interesting because that's kind of that you jumped to exactly where I was going a little bit because it's the Requiem for Katrina that for me just watching you as an artist, you know, going from soundtrack and then going back and hearing like the hardcore jazz like in New York Scene and the stuff that you do with Wynton and that was with Art Blakey, that particular album, he was the veteran at the time and you were the young man coming up, that's like 1984 time, right?
Yeah, early 80s, yeah. Yeah.
You know? So I look at these influences and I think about the soundtracks. And of course, soundtracks are very operatic in their nature, as we were saying earlier. Mm-hmm. You know, or as I was mentioning, and it was really in that idea of the Requiem for Katrina that I, as a listener, heard a flip. Mm. A conversion, and okay. You just said it just now. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, well, I didn't really earn the Grammy.
Mm-hmm.
The city of New Orleans did.
Yes,
and that's exactly what opera composers say. You know, it's like huh. Giuseppe Verdi never mm-hmm. set out to write an opera about the Risorgimento.
Mm-hmm.
He wrote an opera about how he felt about his people.
Yes,
and then the people took the opera to the streets.
Yeah.
To protest the French.
Yes, isn't that something?
Isn't that something?
Yeah.
You know, hundreds of years later, music and mm-hmm. opera still has the same appeal.
Yes.
So to me, I feel that. And champion mm-hmm. a little bit. So I kind of wanted to ask you, you know, when did you make your personal mm-hmm. connection with opera? What was the first opera you heard, and what influenced you artistically?
Well, you know, a lot of people don't know this about me, but my father studied opera. So
okay, I know. I didn't know.
Yeah, I know a lot of people. You know, they look at me as a jazz musician, but they don't realize that I heard opera in my home from the time that I was a little boy.
Wow.
You know, my father would play all of the classics, you know, in the home, and he was a baritone, and he studied with a guy named Osceola Blanchett, and my father's name was Oliver Blanchard.
Okay.
And Osceola Blanchett was a guy, he was an African-American guy who took it upon himself to really, you know, take young African-Americans who were interested in music and teach them opera. My father happened to be one of them. So I had heard the music over and over, and that was that experience, and in telling that story to a friend of mine in St. Louis was the reason why they called me to do the opera, because when they were talking about doing this hybrid jazz kind of opera thing, a friend of mine who was there, why am I blanking on his name right now? It'll come to me. But my friend... he said, listen, I have the perfect guy because he heard opera and he's a jazz musician. And that's how the whole thing came about. So for me, opera was a very personal thing and a very powerful thing in my life because listening to Corman, you know, as a kid, I didn't get it at first. You know, when I was a kid, you know, my dad would put on the records and you hear doors slamming in the house because everybody's trying to find some peace and quiet. You know, because my dad would be sitting in the front of the house.
Yeah, I'm still your
just,
dad.
Yeah, just singing away, you know what I mean? And that was back in the days when you had the Philips recordings with the wax paper, and I was not allowed to touch those recordings.
Oh, no, they were holy, sacred pieces.
Yeah, yeah, man. I used to look at them with reverence, like, wow, this is great, you know? So being called to actually do one and to create an opera was a very emotional thing for me because my father's not around anymore. But, you know, I looked at it and I go, wow. I started to question, like, whether everything that I experienced in my life led me to that moment. You know, like, mm-hmm. I studied composition here with Roger Dickinson, who's a great classical composer, and studied jazz, obviously, then, you know, started... working in the jazz world as a performing artist, and then Spike called me to start working on his films. And when I started doing the film thing, I remember having a conversation with Roger, and Roger told me, he said, listen, you're getting experience in learning how to write for orchestra to do something bigger than this. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't see what it was at the time.
Wow.
And next thing you know, here it is, I'm writing an opera. And for me, it was... And it still is an amazing experience. I'm working on my second one right now.
I was going to ask you about that because I got a little bit of the subject matter last night from Robin. I didn't know if you could discuss it or not.
Yeah, we could talk about it. I mean, it's Charles Blow's book called Fire Shut Up in My Bones, where, you know, this guy was from Gibbsland, Louisiana. And the opera is basically about his struggles growing up, being molested as a youth, and his struggles with his own identity, trying to figure out who he is and how it's still affecting his life today.
Wow.
But going back to Champion, you know, the thing that was really amazing about that entire experience for me was, you know, I kept having these flashbacks, man, to my youth, you know, writing this music because my mom's sister, she's also a vocal coach and plays piano. So I heard this type of music in my house all the time. I was the black sheep bringing the jazz recordings into the house.
You were the bad boy.
Yeah.
With the jazz.
Yeah,
that's so amazing.
Yeah, I mean, in my house, they were like, okay, that's great, but you need to keep up with this. And I'm like, okay, no, I love that too, but I also love this. So that's why I said earlier, having all of those experiences seemed to have led me to this point, in this moment in time. And it's, man, I can't tell you the type of experience that it's been. You know, sitting in a room, putting, you know, notes on a page, hearing, because you got to remember, you talked about my film career. Being a film composer, when I start writing, the product is done.
Right, that's true.
You know, I'm looking at it, I'm seeing the scenes, I'm getting a sense of pace from the dialogue,
right.
You know, the way things are cut together versus what I read in the script.
Which is the great thing I love about your style, because you can actually hear you riffing on the dialogue.
Oh, no, thank you. Yeah. No, that's a product of working with Spike, but I'll tell you about that later. but this was totally different, because I'm sitting in a room imagining what this is all going to be, and I'll never forget it, man. When we started to block Champion for the first time, I got emotional. It blew me away.
Wow.
You know, because to see these characters move around on stage,
yeah,
and interact, you know, that were coming and singing notes that were coming from my mind, it was just an overwhelming thing. And then to have great people doing it at the same time, man, it was just an incredible experience. That's why I've always told those guys, you know, in St. Louis, I've been very, very grateful and feel very, very blessed to have started this section of my life with them, because, you know, they're very dedicated people and they do great work.
They're wholly dedicated to their art in every way. Paul Kilmer is an amazing man.
Yes, and very funny, too.
He's hilarious.
Yes.
If you need a joke, or if you even feel a little bit blue,
right?
You know,
right,
I mean, right, he hosts the rehearsals, right?
Right, right.
He comes and checks on everybody. He goes around and makes sure everybody's cool.
Right,
you know.
Right.
But he was at my opera debut.
Oh, nice.
Because it was the Hinsdale Opera, this old company in Chicago.
Okay.
You know, they lasted for a long time. They do like two productions a year.
Wow.
And yeah.
Cool.
It was amazing.
Yeah.
You know, full artist, a lot of lyric opera apprenticed artists, and Paul was one of them.
Nice.
And I got a small part, you know, just a walk-on, you know, one-liner kind of thing. I was 18 years old.
Uh-huh.
And Paul Kilmer was my you know, my buddy.
Uh-huh.
I was his village idiot, as it were. So we would like follow each other around on stage during the choruses and, have fun.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Make it really fun for everybody.
Well, that's the thing I think people don't really understand. Who've never been to opera, it's really a great experience.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I always talk about in opera, in this day and age when all the young kids want to deal with virtual reality,
right?
To me, that's exactly what opera is. You know what I mean? It's you see these three-dimensional.
It's like the analog.
Yes, it's the analog version.
Yeah.
You know, and listen, I didn't get it until I was commissioned by St. Louis, and they brought me in to see their season one year, and I saw Zalame, I saw Ghost of Versailles, and I can't remember the third one. But I watched these performances, and, man, I was so juiced. I was so hyped, you know, because I'm sitting there saying, wow, the sky's the limit, you know, in terms of telling a story, because this is not something, you know, where you're looking at it on a TV screen. These are people, in some cases, that come out in to the audience. It's a 3D experience. It's interactive, you know?
Yeah.
And I was just blown away by that experience.
Well, it's funny, because when I first heard about this opera happening, you know, back in 2013, that's when I first got wind of it. That's when the world started to, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'd known about the commission, but you know how that stuff is.
Sure.
In and out of your psyche. But when I really thought about it for the first time, you know, it really resonated. It made sense to me, because, you know, there's no closer equal to the tenor than the trumpet.
Trumpet. Interesting, yeah.
You know, it's the same kind of obbligato line.
Mm-hmm.
It's high.
Mm-hmm.
It's exemplary, you know, and it's vocal writing.
Yes. Well, you know what's interesting about it is one of the reasons why I love cello.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, I love the cello, because to me the cello seems like it sounds like it's in a vocal range for me.
Oh, yeah.
You know, in terms of how I relate to sound.
Like a gorgeous mezzo
or
a beautiful baritone voice.
Exactly, exactly.
That's Plácido Domingo's favorite instrument.
Get out of here. I didn't know that.
That's true.
Really?
He always said he wanted his voice to sound like a cello if he could emulate any instrument.
Wow. Now I'm going to have to go back and listen again.
I know, because it's actually there. Yeah. It's actually there.
Wow, that's interesting.
Yeah,
that's
to me, these are the details, right? This is the artist is how they think, you know?
And of course. Yeah. Listen, man, you know, one of the things I think that's also interesting about this was the realization of, because you got to remember, being African-American, growing up in New Orleans, opera, you know, and even though I grew up with opera in my house, to most people, my friends, opera was something that existed in another world.
Yeah.
And one of the things that's been like the big revelation for me, because working on this opera with all of these productions, the number of people who grew up in the church,
mm-hmm.
who started out in the church,
yeah.
and became great opera singers, yeah. you know, and they bring all of that experience to bear mm-hmm. in the performances, you know, like the woman who's going to be singing here, Karen Slack.
Yeah.
She is phenomenal.
Yeah.
You know, she performed the role when we did it in San Francisco with Opera Parallel, and she got a standing ovation every night.
Wow.
And I was one of the ones standing every night.
Well, her particular role is the toughest role, I would say.
Oh, of course.
Right?
Of course.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit, because, you know, Emile Griffith is not the go-to guy a lot of people think of to right. make an opera about.
I know.
Now, as it turns out, mm-hmm. he's actually an amazing person to make an sure. opera about, because mm-hmm. he touches on so many worlds, mm-hmm. you know. And right now, to me, the opera hasn't even grown any dust since 2013.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because the topics that you were dealing with in yes. 2013 have doubled
relevant.
Down.
Yes.
You know, in this new era we're in.
Well, it's very yeah. relevant. You know, it's one of the things that's interesting to hear you say that, because when I originally brought the idea to the board who was commissioning me to do it, they didn't get it. They said, "Oh, a boxing opera?" I'm like, "No, it's not a boxing opera."
Mm-hmm.
So I actually sent them the book, 9, 10 and Out, which was the autobiography. And the line that made me want to do the opera was when he said, "I killed a man." Well, I guess I should give some background about the story
first.
Yeah,
give us your capsule if you think
sure,
you don't
yeah, mind. Sure. So Emile Griffith was a welterweight champion in 1965, mm-hmm. and he had fought Benny Perrette twice, and each one of the guys had won one of the bouts, and they were fighting for a third time. Mm-hmm. And like anything, you know, Benny was trying to get a little advantage over psychological advantage over Emile in the press conference. So he used a very derogatory term for a gay male in the press conference, and Emile kept saying, "Why is he saying this?" Mm-hmm. Because even though Emile was a gay man, he never came out and said that he was gay.
Right.
And for this to go public was a big deal for him. And when they started to, when the fight started, the night before the fight, Emile had a premonition that he shouldn't go through with it. The interesting thing about it, too, is that Benny Perrette had just fought a guy named Gene Fulmer, who was a big, heavy hitter.
Yeah.
And, you know, back in those days, those guys wouldn't take a year off. They would fight, and then 2 months later, they would have another fight.
It was like show business.
Yes,
every weekend.
Yeah.
You know, they got my $200, right?
Right. So Benny wasn't really fully recovered from that fight. Yeah. And then he got into this fight with Emile, and Emile caught him in a corner. And there's a line in the opera, 17 blows in less than 7 seconds. And yeah. you can actually watch it. There's videotape of it. And he knocks out Benny Perrette. He wins the fight. Benny Perrette, as he's being taken out of the ring, falls into a coma. He lasts for about 10 days, and then he dies.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Emile's life just takes a tailspin after that. He didn't fight for a while. They actually took Friday Night Fights off the air because of it.
Mm-hmm.
And then actually when Emile tried to fight again because he had to make a living, you can watch it in the fights. Anytime one of the opponents backed up in a corner, he never followed him. You know, so the whole
wow.
experience still had a very profound effect on his life,
yeah.
you know, to the point, you know, where, you know, he was in a bad way,
yeah.
you know, but there's a line in his autobiography that made me want to do it. He said, "I killed a man and the world forgave me, yet I love the man and the world wants to kill me." And to me, that's a very powerful line.
Yeah.
And it, unfortunately, is still a very relevant line. You know, and I also thought about it because it hit me that this guy became world champion. And I thought about the first time I won my first Grammy. We were talking about it.
Yeah.
As soon as they called my name, man, without thinking, the first thing I did was to turn around and kiss my wife and go up and receive the award, because I'm sharing the moment with somebody that I love, right?
Yeah.
And to think that this guy could not share that moment with somebody that he loved blew me away. And I don't know how it came to that. It just hit me one day thinking about it. Mm-hmm. And that made me really want to tell this guy's story, because his story is not a story about being a gay male. His story is a story of redemption. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And the power of that and how this guy survived. Because in the documentary, Ring of Fire, he actually, even though he's suffering from dementia, he wants to go and meet the son of Benny Perrette, Benny Perrette Jr., years later. And as he's a...
he wants to make amends.
Right, after he had become a grown man.
Yeah.
And you see it. It's in a documentary. He's standing there in Central Park talking to him. And the son says, well, my mom couldn't bring herself to come. And Emil goes, I know. And then Benny Perrette Jr. says, he says, listen, from the family to you, we just want to tell you, we don't harbor any bad feelings. Yeah. And Emil starts to cry. You can tell that he'd been carrying the weight of this around all of his entire life. Because what other people, the other thing people don't really realize about these guys that I learned later after I started working on the opera is that they were friends. They used to play basketball together.
Yeah.
And as a matter of fact, when Benny fell into the coma, Emil tried to visit him, and the family just couldn't have him there, and he never got a chance to say goodbye.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. See, that's a slice of life right there. And that's the very stuff. Those are the kind of circumstances that opera teaches.
Yes, yes.
You know, life regrets, especially when we think about PTSD. I mean, if you think of the circumstances of that moment when he killed this guy for whatever reason, whatever loss of control, whatever moment that was, that snap, you know, That's the tragic moment for everyone.
Yes.
And we all feel that. We all have that moment. I mean, even if it's like dropping the kids off at the wrong place.
Sure.
That moment where you clutch your heart, you know. And that's what I love about opera, is that it brings that clutch of heart to us in a very passive yet beautiful way for us to accept, so that you can really storytell with this.
Well, the thing about opera to me that makes it powerful is that it opera can make you drop your guard. You know, you can come into any theater and sit there and say, okay, because I did it when I went to the view Salome, and I'm sitting there going, okay, well, what is this about?
Right.
And the next thing you know, I'm an emotional wreck, because the story was just very powerful. Same thing with Ghost of Versailles.
Yeah.
And, you know, a story like this combined with great directing and great performances, I can't stress that enough.
Yeah.
You know, the performances... Arthur Woodley is an amazing vocalist and an amazing actor.
We are so lucky to have him.
He is ridiculous. Mm-hmm. You know, Arby Ellicott, he's the young up and coming guy who's making a huge name for himself.
He's got some really intense energy.
You know,
I listened to the aria last night, you know, just kind of putting together the research again, because he's got a real handle on it.
Yes.
You know, I mean, it's like an actor's soliloquy.
Well, here's the thing that's like really interesting about this to me, because it's a modern opera. So many of the vocalists relate to the story themselves. You know what I mean? Because of the things they've gone through in their own lives.
Oh, yeah.
When we workshopped the opera, there was a young kid, I can't remember his name now, but he was playing the role of Emil the Fighter. And when he sang the aria, What Makes a Man, he cried.
Yeah.
And he started talking about, he said, this is going to become my audition piece for the rest of my life.
Good for him.
Yeah. I was very honored by him saying that. But to me, it spoke to the power of Emil's journey.
Yeah.
You know, because like you said, I'm just trying to tell this guy's story.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's one of those things where I feel weird taking credit for this, because this was his journey. The power of his spirit to endure all of that.
Skin you wear.
That was Aubrey Alacoque singing young Emile's aria from Champion, What Makes a Man, by Terence Blanchard and Michael Christopher. Now back to the interview.
I learned this being a film composer. One of my, my mentor in the film business was a guy named Miles Goodman, who was a dear friend of mine who died too early. But one of the things he used to tell me all the time, he said, listen, he did his own orchestrations, but he always had an orchestrator. And I asked him, I said, well, why? He said, listen, man, you need to have an objective set of ears.
Yeah.
You know, he says, because sitting in a room by yourself, objectivity can go out the window sometimes.
That's right.
You know what I mean?
Here's my new aria. It's an hour long.
Exactly. You know,